you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 139 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyree, your host as usual. Today I have something a little special for all of you. As many of you know, I started this podcast a long time ago, in part because, well, I'm a podcast junkie. And the very first podcast that I ever listened to, one that I listen to religiously to this day, as many of you also know, is the Mac Power Users, hosted by Katie Floyd and David Sparks. Well, recently, Katie announced that she's leaving Mac Power Users after 450 some odd episodes, which is a feat I just can't even imagine. And I'm going to miss her because I've spent countless hours listening to her and David talk about things Mac and Apple related, as well as, you know, just simply how to get things done in today's technology oriented world. And Katie is an attorney. She's actually a little more than that these days, but you can delve into her background on your own. But she was kind enough to appear on this program way back a couple of years ago, almost to the day, on episode 40. And I thought, as an homage to Katie Floyd and Mac Power Users, I don't really have a lot that I can give her, frankly, anything that I can give her as a thank you for the hours, as I said, of enjoyment that she has provided me. So as a small tribute to her and as a farewell thank you, I thought we would re-air episode 40 of The Law Entrepreneur, and you can hear how Katie went from being corporate lawyer to a solo practitioner. And it was one of the first episodes that we did that I really felt like I was achieving something by getting somebody like Katie to appear on the podcast. So I'm delighted to present once again for your listening enjoyment, soon to be the former host of Mac Power Users, none other than Katie Floyd. Hey there, Katie Floyd. Welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Well, thank you, Neil, for having me. I've been a longtime listener and happy to finally join you.
Well, I tell you what, I have to confess that that makes me feel so good because, as I mentioned to your partner, and we'll get into this a little bit later, David Sparks, previously, it is your podcast that has started me down this path of ruin here in terms of my devotion to podcasting in general into the Mac Power Users. So for those of you listening who don't recognize Katie's voice, you should. She's the other half of the duo that hosts the very popular Mac Power Users, along with David Sparks. And Mac Power Users was the very first podcast that I ever listened to, and I've listened to it religiously. So to think that you're listening to mine is really humbling. So I'm very grateful to that. Katie, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you came to the practice of law and where you are today.
Well, by day, I'm a practicing attorney. By night, as you mentioned, I podcast and have a blog on Apple and technology-related things. I've been a practicing attorney for about 10 years, and one of the things that specifically brought me to the Law Entrepreneur podcast is 2 months ago, September 1 of 2016, I decided to become an entrepreneur, and I said goodbye to the man or to the woman, and as the case may be, and decided to open my own practice. I've worked for almost 10 years for other people. role as an associate and as of counsel and various positions in the law, and been very fortunate to work for some wonderful people and in some wonderful firms, but just decided that it was time for me to do something more, and it came at a good time in my life. And I've just wrapped up month number two, and I've got to say, I'm not sure I would ever look back. I am loving life, both personally and professionally, having more fun practicing law now than I ever have before, and also working a lot harder than I ever have before. So,
well, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
It seems to be. But even my friends and family say, you know, you seem a lot happier than you were 6 months ago. And I didn't think I was that miserable to live with 6 months ago, but I guess I'll take that as a compliment.
Sure. Well, let's roll back the clock a little bit. I know you're a Florida gal, University of Florida, Gator, as it were, and you went to law school there as well. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm actually a triple Gator. I got my undergraduate, my law degree, and went back after several years absence and picked up an LLM, a Master's of Law in Taxation from the University of Florida as well.
So you've helped build an entire wing down there in Gainesville.
I try not to give them too much of my money, but it happens.
Sure. Did you know that you were going to be an attorney? Did you always aspire to be an attorney, or how did that come about?
It depends, I guess, on who you ask. I think if you ask my parents, they would probably tell you that that was always inevitable, but that was not my plan. I am the only attorney in my family. Neither of my parents and none of my extended family members are attorneys. So I didn't think it was necessarily the path that I was heading down. I was actually headed down a path into journalism. When I was in middle school and high school, I was always very much a newspaper and yearbook geek. And I think most of that was because desktop publishing was just coming into its infancy in the late 80s and early 90s. And I liked those kinds of courses because they were the courses where I got to spend time in the computer lab and do those types of things. And so those were the courses that I focused on in high school and in college. And in fact, had a job. I worked for a couple of years for a publishing company out of college, worked for them while I was in college, and then had a job that continued after college. But September 11th happened, and my minor was always in political science, and that was just something that I was interested in, and kind of felt this need to do something more, I think, like a lot of people felt in at that time and at that place, and ended up working on Capitol Hill for a time period. And really enjoyed certain things that came with that, but not necessarily being up in Capitol Hill and being in the middle of politics and those types of things. And really decided from there that the next logical step was law school.
Interesting. Whereabouts did you live in the district?
I lived very near Eastern Market. I think Southeast 9th Street. I rented a place and it was incredibly expensive, as you probably know. I lived nine blocks from the Capitol. I remember I used to walk to work. I worked for a congresswoman and we used to walk to work back and forth every day. And during the summers, that was not always the most pleasant.
Right. And the humidity that we have here in the district. But it's still, that part of town is really very popular these days, Capitol Hill. Especially with the millennials, there's a lot of influx of youth and talent into DC. So it's a terrific place to live.
Yeah, I think I lived there while it was kind of transitioning. You could definitely see it heading that direction, but parts of it were not always so nice. You definitely didn't necessarily want to be out at night.
Exactly. Well, and then you went back to Florida and you enrolled in law school. Now, did you know what type of attorney you wanted to be when you went to law school?
I thought I did, and I ended up never practicing in that area.
That's a common theme.
I thought that I wanted to be a prosecutor. I tended to believe if you walked like a duck, you talked like a duck, you were a duck, and pretty much everybody was guilty. And I didn't really know that there were any other types of law besides people who actually stood up and went to a courtroom all day. I couldn't imagine going to law school and not practicing that type of law. And as I got a little further into law school, I've got some exposure to some different things. And realized that there were other areas of the law and that, you know, maybe not everybody who walked and talked like a duck actually was a duck and those types of things. And ended up graduating from law school in 2007, which you may recall there were some interesting things going on with the economy in 2007. And was very fortunate to have a job, to actually have a couple of job offers. But, you know, kind of it was the work that you could find. And so I ended up working for a big insurance defense firm. For my first job in a larger city in Florida for a couple of years was working for a big insurance defense firm, mainly because, you know, I felt very fortunate to have that position because when I turned around you know, most of my colleagues were not employed.
Yeah, indeed. And it was a very tough legal environment there for several years. So any job was a good job in some respects in the law.
Right.
So how long did you stay in practice in big law?
I was with the big insurance defense firm for 2 years, and that was it was pretty good experience. I mean, I think I probably took, you know, a couple of depositions a week. It was, you know, kind of one of those, you know, big churn things. It was very high pressure to bill. I think I had a billable goal of something like 2,200 hours a year or something like that. It was it was pretty high pressure to bill and to crank out the work. After that, I was able to move back home and got into a little bit smaller firm where I was still doing, you know, more general civil litigation. I did a lot of real estate related litigation, but I was more in a firm of, it fluctuated between mainly 5 and 7 attorneys and a lot better environment, a lot better people, you know, rather than being under, you know, the constant bill. I mean, billing was still obviously very important, but one of the things that I learned is it's not necessarily the area of law that you practice, but more so who you practice it with that is so important.
Yeah, I think that's a common experience with a lot of attorneys. So you went from big law to, say, relatively small/medium law practice. And so you're able to get a little more insight, I think, I would expect, into the operations and the logistics of running a law firm in the smaller firm that you went to.
Yeah, and it was great because although I was an associate at that smaller firm, it was a small enough firm that they never really treated me like an associate. You know, I always attended all the weekly meetings. They valued my opinion. I was able to chime in on things and was actually given a lot of responsibility and really treasured that experience.
Now, did you like being in court? Did you like the courtroom experience?
It depends. I felt like because of the type of practice that I was in and the area that I was in, I did like being in court. I still like going to court. In fact, I was just in court yesterday morning, and I like that you can make a difference in people's lives. I like the thrill of being in court. I like being in court enough to keep sharp and to stay on my toes. But I also think that there can be a lot of pettiness there. And I think depending on the areas of law that you're practicing, you know, if you're suing people over relatively minimal amounts of money, and I understand that they're important amounts of money for them, people who are involved in these cases, but it just seemed like a lot of the cases that I was involved in day to day, you know, it just felt like at the end of the day, nobody was ever happy. You know, if we won, they were mad that they spent all the money and won because they were always right in the first place. And of course, if they lost, people tended to forget why they came to a lawyer in the first place, and that it's clearly the reason they lost must have been all your fault.
Right, right. Well, that's the litigator's lament, isn't it?
Yeah. So mainly the court that I'm in now primarily is when I'm dealing with guardianships and contested probates and those types of things. And I find those a lot more satisfying for one reason, because I'm helping people. There tend to be more definitive resolutions, and I'm helping people come to resolutions. And typically any resolution that we come to is better than kind of the stalemate that they're in when we start.
Right. So now, I mean, I happen to know from having spoken to you before and following you in the past that you are transitioning more towards an estate practice. That's what you got your LLM in taxation with an emphasis on estate planning, correct?
Right. I started that transition probably about 4 or 5 years ago. It was actually a personal event in my own life with a family member who unfortunately went through a period of dementia and then ultimately passed. And really, I had never had any exposure to that world before. Very, very fortunately, everybody in my family had been very healthy until that point, and we really lived a charmed life and never saw those types of things happen. And then it all came crashing down and realized, you know, who can help us with this? And there were certainly some people and some attorneys and CPAs and accountants who did help us with that. But a lot of the time, my family members were turning to me saying, well, you're the attorney, what do we do? And I said, I do mainly real estate related law. Well, I don't have any idea. And I was having to figure out a lot of this stuff. And it's when you're in a situation with that, you meet a lot of people who are in similar situations, and you kind of develop a community, because this is a period that had gone on for several years. And I thought, well, this is really kind of an area where people need a lot of help. And I still get a lot of gratification helping people. I mean, these are very, very difficult times in people's lives, but helping people through these difficult times, but hopefully being proactive and helping plan for them. Because when something happens, as horrible as that is, knowing that there's a plan and this is what we're going to do is just like having a lifeboat.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been through largely the same experience. I was on the other side of the litigation experience when I started doing personal injury, representing plaintiffs in their court cases. And while I still do that, and I've also done some family law, I too have migrated a little bit to the estate planning arena for just exactly the same reasons. In my own case, it was my mother who passed away. With the will that we had helped prepare for her sitting on the kitchen table unsigned, because, you know, she hadn't gotten around to resolving in her mind one little minor issue, which really was minor, and it kept her from signing the will. And in that whole process, I experienced the same thing. You find that people look to you because you're the attorney, and you say, well, geez, I do personal injury, car accident. So it's an interesting transition. It's one of the things that I like about the law, is that if you find an area that you are suddenly drawn to, with a little bit of effort, you can pivot and start and practice in that area with some guidance and some support and some assistance. But largely, it's open to you. And I think that's an interesting thing about the practice of law.
Yeah, and for me, getting the LLM was important. One is I've always been a big proponent of education. Whether the LLM was necessary is really another question, but it was what gave me that comfort level to be able to make the transition. To me, it gave me that additional level of comfort. It was 2 years out of my life, and as you probably know, not an inexpensive proposition to go back and get an LLM. But it was a lot of additional knowledge and a lot of additional training in a more structured program that I felt gave me that support network and that foundation of knowledge to be able to make that transition.
Yeah, I think it's really important too, because I know, at least in our state, it's a tricky area. If you're an estate planning attorney, oftentimes you get questions about the effect on taxation and taxes. And you need to make really sure that you know what you're talking about if you're giving tax advice to a prospective client. So I think in your case, taking that LLM, you know, gives you that comfort level and that knowledge to know that you have the right answers.
Well, or if nothing else, it at least gives me that comfort level to see there's an issue here.
Yeah.
We need to either resolve it or find someone who can help you resolve it.
Get someone to help us, sure. So now with your own practice, do you see your solo practice gravitating to one area over another, or are you going to try and keep your fingers on a couple of other buttons aside from estate planning?
Well, I want to be very cognizant of a few things. You know, certainly I need to pay the bills and keep the doors open, but I've never wanted to be a jack of all trades and a master of none. So I've tried to limit my practice to a few key areas. And if I'm not the right attorney for somebody, really develop a good referral network that I can put them in touch with the right person.
And sure.
So I still do some civil litigation. I'm still comfortable with certain aspects of that. And I still stay informed and up to date on that. You know, for example, I have an interesting niche landlord-tenant practice because I did quite a bit of that at the old firm. And I have a number of clients who just won't let me stop doing it. I continue to do that, and I'll take on new clients in that area. And I do some other civil litigation matters, but I limit it. But primarily, I'm focusing in estate planning, probate, guardianships, and areas that are ancillary to that.
Great. So let's now talk a little bit about, you know, the decision to go solo. When you made that decision, what were your concerns, if any, and what were your objectives?
The obvious concern is, am I going to make any money? Are people still going to come to me, and am I going to be able to eat and put food on the table? And one of the concerns in particular for me is I'm single. There is no plan B. I don't have a spouse who has insurance coverage or a second income or anything like that to to provide support if, you know, if this doesn't work or if it takes a few months to get off the ground. So I was very cognizant from the very beginning, even in the early planning stages, that I was the answer to all of the problems, and I was also the problem. So I had to figure it out.
What did you do to mitigate that risk?
One of them is I've always been a planner, and I've always been very cautious, and I've always been very financially conservative. So for me, having a security blanket in the form of just enough savings that I knew that I could last several months, even if nobody came through the door, was very important to me. So I don't know if you're familiar with Dave Ramsey and his teachings of basically pay off your debt and those types of things.
Yep.
But I've kind of been a follower of his for many years and wanted to make sure that before I embarked on this journey that I had myself, you know, personally and professionally in a good place, that, you know, it wasn't just a wing and a prayer. And I think if you can do that, it's certainly to a benefit, although I know not every solo has the luxury of time and planning and being able to put themselves in ideal circumstances to do so. But to the extent that you can, it's definitely what allows me to sleep at night.
Yeah, it's really critical. And as you accurately point out, not everybody has that luxury of being able to prepare their runway, so to speak, and, you know, pocket the money and have a safety security blanket. Some people are thrust into this role, and it can be a daunting and terrifying position.
The other piece that comes with that is I try very hard did a lot of planning initially when I went into the solo practice to keep my monthly expenses low. I knew that particularly for the type of law that I practice, having an office front was very, very important, having something that...
Yeah, that was going to be my next question to you. Did you go through that analysis as to, you know, location, office, virtual office, home office?
I did, and that was the hardest piece because I'm set up that I could do my job completely from my house. That would bring some interesting challenges. Number one, I tend to be more of an introvert by nature, and I was afraid that if I set myself up to do that, I could possibly go weeks without seeing right. another person.
I know the feeling.
That might not necessarily be such a good thing. But the other challenge of that is the type of practice that I have, although it certainly doesn't happen every day, you want it to happen more often than not, is I have face-to-face meetings with clients. Clients come in my office, we sit down around a conference room, we talk about their concerns, their wants, their needs, and we put together an estate plan for them. And then a couple of weeks later, they come back and we sign everything. So having an office front was definitely important. I looked around. I live in a smaller town. I mean, we're probably about a quarter million, but we did not have any really good corporate office share type arrangements that didn't look tacky, for lack of a better word. I mean, there were a couple of arrangements where you could rent an office space with a shared conference room. And I looked at, we probably have about two of those in town. And I looked at both of them, but neither of them really passed the smell test. And I mean that figuratively, not literally. But they both just kind of, if I was looking at them from an outside perspective, your clients would very clearly know that you were doing this on the cheap and it just didn't feel good. What I ended up doing was actually I found another solo attorney who had some office space to rent and someone that I was compatible with. I actually spoke to a couple of people, had a couple of options, and was able to pick the best one of those.
This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight. Daylight is the Mac CRM and case management tool I've been using for years to manage my practice. If you're feeling swamped trying to keep track of cases and clients, but you don't want to pay the hefty price tag of something like Salesforce or other legal-specific tools, I recommend you give Daylight a look. Daylight helps me prioritize my day. It helps me keep track of my clients, cases, documents, emails, calendars, to-dos, and reminders, all in one place. The case management part of Daylight makes it really easy to organize all the details and work for each case so things are done on time. The best part of Daylight is that it lets you work offline. You don't need an internet connection to pull up case details or info about a client like with other CRMs and case management tools. And new in Daylight is their Zapier integration, so you can automate things like pulling new leads from a contact form on your website right into Daylight. And for techies like me, you know that integration with tools like Zapier is really fundamental to making something like Daylight work the way you want it to work. So to learn how Daylight can help you grow your practice, visit marketcircle.com/daylight. And be sure to let them know you heard about Daylight through The Law Entrepreneur to get a 50% discount on your first month subscription. That's Daylight by Market Circle. The legal environment is more competitive than ever, and small law firms are feeling the pinch. With over 1.3 million attorneys in the United States and counting, it can be hard to stand out from the crowd. And that's why Spotlight Branding helps lawyers become unforgettable. Spotlight Branding is a different kind of internet marketing company. They don't put their clients on the SEO hamster wheel, and they don't ask them to burn thousands of dollars on speculative pay-per-click advertising. Instead, they're focused on the fundamentals of legal marketing that have worked for dozens upon dozens of years. They use the internet to build a premium brand for solo and small firm lawyers like myself, and they put systems in place to create top-of-mind awareness, allowing their clients to maximize the referrals and repeat business. It's the smart way to grow your law firm. To get more information, visit spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in The Law Entrepreneur, and receive a special gift from our friends there at Spotlight Branding. Spotlight Branding, helping lawyers become unforgettable. Support for today's episode comes from Ruby Receptionists, dedicated to helping you grow your practice one happy caller at a time. From their offices in Portland, Oregon, Ruby's live remote receptionists create an exceptional experience for your callers by answering calls live with your custom greeting, delighting callers in English or Spanish, transferring calls, taking messages, collecting new client intake, and much more. Just like an in-house receptionist at a fraction of the cost. For 15 years, Ruby has been turning rings into relationships. For more information, call 844-895-7829 or visit callruby.com/lawentrepreneur. Yeah, so that's the analysis you went through. You ended up in a shared space with another practitioner. And so now you got to sign a lease. Did you need to outfit the office or did it come furnished?
That was the beauty of it. I was actually in talks with about three different people. And so I was able to pick the one that was, you know, best for me. You know, one of them had a great location. One of them already came furnished. One of them had a nicer building. And so, you know, I had to weigh some of the pros and cons. The one that I ended up with was a little bit higher priced than the other three, but it had a great location. Very nice conference room. And he had some leftover furniture from someone who had previously was in there. And he said, look, I'll be happy to move the furniture out, but if you want to use it, you're welcome to. And I was able to use most of the furniture that was in the existing space. So I still had to, I probably had to lay out, you know, probably about $5,000 initially to outfit the office, but, you know, much less than if I was starting from scratch.
Yeah. Starting with four walls.
Right.
Then what did you do in terms of, you know, phones, technology, you know, that kind of setup?
Well, since you've mentioned before, I am a little bit of a technology aficionado. So I was fortunate that most of the physical technology for the office, I happen to have spares of. I happen to have a spare Mac Mini laying around because I just have those things. I was using it a little bit as a home server and realized, you know, I really don't need a home media server. I've got a NAS that does a lot of that stuff now. And so I wiped that and repurposed that and brought that into the office. I did have to pick up a few peripherals. Like I didn't have a monitor for that machine, so I had to buy a monitor. I had to buy a nice laser printer. The office that I'm in has one of those big multifunction, you know, copy fax scan machine. So part of my rent includes use of that machine. So I didn't have to worry about that. I did buy a ScanSnap scanner. I have one at home and I thought about taking it to the office, but I realized, you know, no, I need a second one. So I had to buy a few peripherals and things like that. And then very fortunately, one of my business contacts actually happens to own a telecom company. So the phones were, I was able to get a fairly inexpensive phone line and add on to that. And Ruby answers my phones. So I have a virtual receptionist with a Ruby receptionist.
Yeah. You and I both use Ruby receptionists and they're phenomenal. I just can't say enough about them. So now you now you're set up in the office. You get your business cards printed and all that. And you had a couple of clients that came with you, I'm assuming.
Yes, I was very fortunate. I have a few steady clients that give me regular work every month. And those clients, and of course, knock on wood, I'm hoping that they continue to stay with me. They more than cover my overhead. So I felt pretty comfortable making that move. And then, as you know, with the estate planning business, there's a lot of churn with that. You know, people come see you and you may not see them ever, but if you do see them again, you probably are not going to see them again for another several years.
So now that brings us to the point of how are you marketing your firm? How are you getting the word out about your practice?
That's a good question. Some of it has been online. I've created a website. I use Squarespace for that, and then did all of the ancillary things that come along with that. I created a Facebook page for my business and a Twitter account for my business and those types of things. And I make a point to create what I consider to be an informational type blog post every week that I put on the website, and it gets cross-posted to all the various social networks. And I try to keep that short, somewhere between, you know, 300 and 500 words. That's not so much selling, but more so to try to be useful information, mainly to my target market, but sometimes to other attorneys. It just kind of depends on what's going on. The big thing I've done is I'm primarily referral based. I sent out very analog announcement cards to all of the attorneys in my circuit, and that was a fairly significant expense when I first started out. But I have gotten so many compliments on sending out those cards, and I've set up so many lunches and gotten quite a bit of business my first 2 months just from people realizing, I didn't know you went out in your womb. That's wonderful. I was just thinking, I have your card sitting here on my desk. I've got someone I can send to you. And that has sustained me really the first couple of months. And then, you know, keeping in contact with those people regularly.
I'm so glad that you mentioned the announcement cards. You know, I'm old. I went to law school late in life, but in my youth and in time when I would normally have gone to law school, that's what everybody did. Everybody sent out announcements cards. That was the main methodology for shouting out to the world that you've opened your own practice. And with the advent of social media and the internet and all of those things, I think there was a time when that was kind of, you know, looked down upon or decried as being old school. But your experience is one that others have repeated to me, that the simple announcement card, old school, has been a valuable marketing tool.
And, you know, I almost didn't do it, Neil, because it was going to be expensive, because I got, you can, maybe it depends on your district, but I got the list from the bar of all of the attorneys in my circuit, and our circuit incorporates our county and then the surrounding counties. And it was like 1,100 attorneys in our circuit. And I'm like, who are these people? I have no idea. So I did go through and I pruned it a little bit. But, you know, I designed the card and I didn't make it flashy. I didn't make it one of these glossy laminate postcards things. It was an actual cardstock linen card in an envelope. And I found out, by the way, that the local print shop for 3 cents a card will address them, stuff them, and lick them for you. And I was like, yes, please.
Yes, please. Yeah.
I was able to actually mail them out using their bulk rate postage. So I was able to get the postage for about half of what I would pay, you know, sticking the envelope on them myself. So it ended up costing me less than I thought, but it was still, you know, I think it was like $1,500 by the time I was done with it.
I will tell you, along those lines, one of the things that I've done since the first year that I opened my solo practice, and people said, Neil, I just think that's kind of cheesy. I send out holiday cards. You know, the list has grown exponentially, but I send holiday cards out to past clients and also to every attorney I've had a case with, win, lose, or draw, because you know, you're going to do business with these people down the road. It's received kind of, you know, similarly. People say, well, nobody does holiday cards anymore. Well, now mine stands out because I'm one of the few.
Yeah, I'm already planning because the holidays are right around the corner as we record this. I've got a list of anybody who has referred me a case or attempted to refer me a case, or who, you know, I've created a little bit of a relationship with. They're getting cookies. My mom has an amazing, I mean, like amazing chocolate chip cookie recipe. No, I'm not going to post it. It's a secret. Don't ask me for it. Don't email me for it. But we're going to have a cookie day where we're going to make a bunch of cookies. And I've already, did you know if you go on the dollar store website, you can order items in bulk for a dollar. We've already bulk ordered cookie tins, and I've ordered stickers with my law firm's logo on there that are, we're going to just make a day of it and go out and deliver stuff.
Now look. What gets better than an attorney delivering you handmade cookies with in a holiday tin with their branding on it? I mean, that's money in the bank.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, that's great. I love that idea. Just as an aside, I'm going to go completely off the track here.
Yeah, because cookies was not in our outline.
No, cookie wasn't in the outline. But I just got to tell you that in doing a little Katie Floyd stalking, you know, I look at all your websites, and katiefloyd.com, which, is it fair to say that's your personal website?
That's my personal website, yeah.
Okay.
Floydlaw.net is the business site.
Right, and we're going to repeat those at the end. But there's a page on katiefloyd.com where you list your favorite things.
Yes.
That's a freaking brilliant page.
Okay.
Because it's not just, you know, it's not just the geeky stuff, you know, your favorite application, your favorite software package, your favorite Apple hardware, but you've got, as you said, your favorite leaf blower, your favorite...
These things are important.
Your favorite hose manufacturer. There's just a number of things on that list, which I, you know, commend our listeners to take a peek at, because it's really very clever.
I built a house about 5 years ago, and so I went through a phase of home-related appliances and supplies. And so, yeah, a couple of those have made the list.
It's great. It's great. I think you really should actually push that forward a little bit, because it's a real value added for people visiting your site.
Okay.
Let's talk a little bit. I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole, because we could be here for hours, but... As we mentioned, you have a geek background, and you're one of the most widely respected and listened to podcasters certainly in the Apple community. Obviously, technology plays an important role in your ability to deliver legal services. How are you structuring that? How are you planning for that?
Well, a couple of things. I think you were at Milo Fest when I gave my talk, and I really have detailed three things that were important to me before I even opened the door of my law practice. And I'll probably figure out more as I go along. I mean, keep in mind, I've only been doing this 2 months.
But you've been a tech geek for years.
Yeah, yeah. But there are a couple of things that were important to me right off the bat. I mean, number one is, it was very important to me that I could work from anywhere. And although I knew that I wanted to have an office presence, and that was important for my clients, I also didn't want to be tied to that office. I wanted to be able to work from home if I decided that I didn't want to go into the office that particular day. In fact, it's 1:30 and I haven't been to the office yet today. I've been out running errands and doing all kinds of crazy things, but I was filing motions and doing things from Starbucks this morning. And I was at a seminar earlier this afternoon and being able to work from there. So I really made sure that I designed my practice and the tools that I used so that it was all of my information synced up through the various tools and devices I use. I happen to be Mac-based, but the services that I use, primarily Dropbox and Google and those types of things, certainly would be cross-platform and work for anybody. But I didn't want to be tied to a physical office. I wanted to be able to work from my Mac, from my office, from home, or from my iOS devices, wherever I wanted to be. The other big thing is, I wanted to be totally paperless. That was very important to me. I have been in offices, the last couple of offices that I worked for, where they had huge dedicated file rooms, and where the amount of paper that they stored and that they had to manage was just overwhelming. I mean, the pure square footage that they had to dedicate to file rooms was just overwhelming. I don't own a file cabinet. And that is so liberating. I mean, I do have some file storage, because sometimes I do have to have paper files temporarily while I'm working on a matter. But the sum total of my file storage is like whatever you can fit in a file drawer in a desk at any particular time. And being able to go totally paperless has certainly helped with, you know, that first goal of being able to work from anywhere, because not having a paper file, you know, means that I don't have to worry about, oh, did I leave the file on my desk somewhere?
Right.
So those things have really been a great help to me. And then I really wanted to be completely cloud-based, whether it's storing my documents in file, having my file management system up in the cloud, and those types of things, because I wanted to be nimble and I wanted to be able to change, because technology changes and things get better. And whatever service you're using today may not necessarily be the best service that's out there tomorrow. And I didn't want to have this. I felt like at some of the other firms that I'd been working for, and they were very well established firms and had a lot of legacy, but that legacy also stuck them in certain places.
Sure. Do you have a practice management tool that you use?
Well, I'm working on that. I very intentionally didn't set up a practice management tool and was not planning on setting one up for my first couple of months of practice, because I really wanted to see how I practiced and what worked best for me.
Sure.
I'm looking at Clio, and I've full disclosure, they're also a sponsor of my podcast, Daylight through Market Circle, although they're certainly not a true practice management system. You can do a lot with them that is practice management related.
Yeah, as you know, I'm a Daylight user. And just recently transitioned my database to the cloud with their new offering of Daylight 6. But your point about seeing how you work and what your workflow is like is an important one, because I know people who have, before they really ramped up their practice, they did, you know, the practice management software tool search and analysis and went through that whole process and picked a tool, only to find out a year later that the tool doesn't really match how they work or how they do business. So I think your approach is the right one, frankly.
Well, and the other thing is, I kind of feel like we're being pecked to death by subscription services now. That's kind of a necessary evil of the app economy that we live in. But, you know, I'm paying, you know, $30 a month to QuickBooks, and you know, $20 a month to my credit card processor, and you know, just all of these little monthly fees that add up. And one of the things that I knew and was very important to me getting started is I wanted to start with certainly everything that I needed, but not necessarily everything that I wanted, because I knew that it would be very easy to just go hog wild. And it would be very difficult to remove things. I can always add things if I decide that I really need them later, but it would be very difficult to remove things once I'd gotten used to having them in my practice.
Sure. And, you know, one of the downsides of taking the approach that you have, and it's frankly one that I ascribe to largely, is setting boundaries, because that work from anywhere cloud-based paperless approach also is a slippery slope to working 24/7. So is there anything that you do explicitly to help establish those boundaries and create that work-life balance?
Well, it's yes and no. One is you can, you know, with my, I don't answer the phone after a certain period of time. For example, I have specific, even though, you know, because I'm on the East Coast and Ruby's on the West Coast, they'll answer my phone and pass through calls up until 9 o'clock.
Right.
And I've flat out told them no. At 5 o'clock, you stop answering the phones. People stop getting put through. If there's a true emergency, they can leave a voicemail, and the voicemail goes to my cell phone that I can pick up if I need to, but it doesn't. And I have had a long-standing policy that unless it's an emergency, and it's an emergency by my definition, not by your definition, I typically don't respond to emails after 5 and on the weekend. Now, I will tell you that I do occasionally, if I am working late or if I'm working, I will respond. I mean, you'll probably get an email. Clients do get emails from me at 5:30 and at 6 o'clock some nights, but they typically don't get emails from me at 7 and 9 and at 2 o'clock on a Saturday. And part of that, and Dave and I have talked a lot about this on our various email shows on Mac Power Users and things like that, is because it's really setting expectations. Now, if there's something going on, if they really need to reach me, if there's a true emergency, absolutely, I'm going to be there. I mean, that's just part of providing customer service. If somebody's got a crisis going on, absolutely, I'm going to be reachable. But a lot of this just, you know, communicating and being available 24/7, it's not good for me and it's not good for them either.
Exactly. And so I think, you know, for our listeners' benefits, that is an important consideration. And you do have to set those boundaries, and you need to give some thought to how to do so and how to make sure that you can still provide quality client service while at the same time trying to maintain a little bit of a separation of your private life and your professional life. And along those lines, I'd like to wrap up here, Katie, a little bit and just ask you, you know, how do you find the time to do all that you do? Because I know your podcast takes a good amount of time. I mean, you do a lot of research and a lot of preparation to produce a quality show that you do. And then you've got, you know, a new practice that you're building. And, you know, how do you fit it in?
Well, if something's important, you make the time.
Sure.
A lot of it is, it's choices. And I do this and I choose not to do other things. I really don't have a lot of other hobbies. I don't play golf. I don't do a lot of the other things that people may consider hobbies. I mean, really the podcast and the tech side of what I do, although it has generated an income and has kind of become a job, that's my hobby, and I'm very thankful that it has, you know, it I guess in some ways it's a curse and a blessing that it has generated an income and kind of blown up as big as it has. But, you know, I pick and choose what I do, and doing a lot limits my ability to say yes to other things. And then I do try to use technology effectively to maximize what I can do. Now, that's a very slippery slope, because sometimes we can use technology for technology's sake, but I always try to be, you know, very mindful of what I'm doing. Is this the best use of my time? Am I maximizing my time efficiently? I mean, we were talking about emails. You know, just because I don't answer emails or respond to emails after a certain time doesn't necessarily mean that I'm not working. I mean, one of the great tools that I use is, you know, I use a service called Sanebox. I defer emails and I defer tasks. You can also send an email and write it and then schedule it to be sent later. So a lot of times I'm doing work on the weekend and I schedule those emails to go out at 9 o'clock on Monday morning. So people think I'm responding first thing on Monday. No, I was working on that, you know, Saturday and Sunday and those types of things. So, you know, using technology effectively can help. And a lot of it's just saying no to things. You know, what is important, what matters, and where do you want to maximize your time?
What are you reading now that's holding your interest?
I read a lot of nonfiction primarily. The fiction book that I've read most recently that I really enjoyed was The Martian. That was probably the last fiction. Oh, I take it back. I did read the Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, but that's kind of like eating candy, so I'm not sure that
yeah.
that counts. There was a book that was recommended at Milo Fest that I'm blanking on the name that I'm reading now. Oh, come on, you can help me with this, Neil. It was the
one that the fella from Atticus.
Yes, yes. I'm just a couple of chapters into it. So I'm obviously it's not making that big of an impression.
We'll look it up and we'll add it to the show notes. But I know you're an avid reader. You do a lot along those lines.
Yeah, the other one that I've read recently, and I've reread it again as I've gotten ready for my business, Dave Ramsey has an Entree Leadership book, is one that I've read recently.
Well, listen, Katie, it's been a huge pleasure for me to have the opportunity to spend a little time with you. As I said, you guys are folks that I really look up to and have enjoyed your podcast a lot. I've had the great pleasure of meeting you at Milo Fest, Mac Track Legal, as it were. I look forward to continuing this conversation on another occasion. Best of luck with a new firm going forward.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Neil.
Once again, I'd like to thank our sponsors for today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur, Ruby Receptionists. They, along with our old friends at Spotlight Branding, as well as Market Circle, the makers of Daylight, are the ones that make this podcast possible, and for them, I am very grateful. So please be sure to visit their websites. You can find the locations in the show notes for this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. Or you can go to our website, thelawentrepreneur.com, and navigate to the resources page, and there you can find a way to get to each of their websites. So please visit their websites, sign on as clients,
I'm a client now of all three, and I think you'll be happy you did so. So that's Ruby Receptionist, Spotlight Branding, and Market Circle, the makers of Daylight.